1997 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 115, Should I Stay or Should I Go? Young Women Questioning the Church, with Linda Quinton-Jones, Ray Hill, and Marty Jones.
Excuse me. Okay, it's only 2 minutes after time to start, so I guess we're doing better than we do on some occasions. My name's Linda Quinton-Jones, and I am the moderator this morning. And this session is sponsored by the Mormon Women's Forum. And our topic was chosen because, number one, we thought it might be appropriate to have something to do with women in the church. And number two, many of us had had issues raised in Relief Society recently about the Young Women's Program and what its influence is on the church. And these questions seem to have come up in several different wards when we were discussing unfulfilled expectations 1 year. And then Ray, one of our panelists here today, came up with some statistics that we were all pretty sure about, but then she found the numbers to back us up. Now, that's not saying there might not be some statistics showing something else out there, but we all know what statistics are for. So these are ours. There's a general social survey, which is a national survey that's been conducted from 1972 through to 1996. And this is nationwide, and it is not sponsored by the church. Okay, it's on the question of church attendance, respondents answer on a 9-point scale from 1, which means never attends church, to 9, attends church at least once a month. In the 70s, the average for LDS men was 4.3. For women, it was 4.8. In the 80s, the average for men was 5.0. For women, it was 5.8. Now, notice that the men is lower than the women, which is what you would expect. The rates for attendance for both were rising. Now, in the 90s, LDS men is 5.3 and still rising. LDS women, it's 5 point, which is down from the 80s. Dr. Heaton, who supplied Ray with these statistics, noted that since it's a national survey, the sample size is for just LDS women and men is small and may account for, you know, really rapid fluctuations. And to control for this, he grouped them and averaged within decades. And it's a small sample, no internal church statistics to back it up, which may not be an accident, but they're interesting figures. And I think we need to ask ourselves why this is happening, and that is another one of the reasons that we chose this topic. Now, we started out, we were going to have just young women on this panel, and then besides the fact that most of the young women had their responses weren't really well thought out, which might be what you would expect at that age. We had some who was, oh, my church, I'll never, you know, I just never think, oh, they're perfect, everything. And then others that, I'm not going in there again. It's just the most horrible place. But there was no, it just seemed to be more of an emotional reaction, which ultimately may be what we have to deal with in a religion, but didn't think it'd be too good for this panel. So we have got a variety. Ray Hill, Ray, is 19 years old. She really seriously questioned the church in her high school years, and now at BYU, we'll let you tell you where she's at. Then there's my daughter, Marty, who at 16 came to BYU and phoned me after her first honors convocation, just in tears, and she said, Mother, do you know that there's other Mormons that believe the same way we do? And then at 20, she said, they're never going to push me out. This is my church, too. And now at 30, she's doing an awfully lot with the English as a Second Language program that the Episcopal Church is running. So we'll let you tell her story. Then we have Kathy Gilliotti. Okay. Who joined the church at age 15 and now has a 15-year-old that is somewhat alienated from the church. Okay, we're going to let each panelist take 10 minutes to kind of give you their story, explain where they're coming from. Then we're going to take questions for a few minutes. We've got a timer up here that's going to tell us when our time is up. And then have some discussion. We have already had some questions that have been submitted over email, and we'd be happy to take any questions from here. What we don't want at that point is the statement questions. You know, a lot of times in discussions like this, we stand up and we give our whole position, and then we say, "Now, what do you think about that?" If you've got direct questions for the panelists, let's have them at that time, and then at the end we'll have another 10 minutes that we hope will be just discussion. At that point, we want to hear your thoughts. Okay, Ray?
Okay, I'm just going to talk about my process of questioning the church. And initially, my questioning of the church came more from a sort of general teenage rebellion than any great ideological reasons. I spent my teenage years in Logan, and my family in the community is very traditional, very conservative, and very Mormon. As a typical oldest child, I resent authority of all kinds, and hence my initial problems with the church were just my way of rebelling against what I perceived to be was the general status quo of society. I can't claim inspired and righteous rebellion, just a subconscious dislike of people telling me what to do. At first, my frustrations focused on the surface requirements and inequality of the church. I hated being forced to attend young women's. I didn't like the cheesy quilting atmosphere there. I disliked the focus on the young men and the inequality of church programs, but most of all, I fumed at the social and spiritual sanctions against the freedom to say and think things which aren't stereotypically Mormon. It seemed to me that the programs of the church, scouting and young women's, only propagated this inequality. There's no equivalent to earning an ego and personal progress. Young men get to go backpacking, ice caving, biking, and fishing, while the young women tie quilts, make cookies, or toll paint. This always infuriated me, as I wanted to backpack, and I'm certainly better at fishing than most of the guys in my ward. For their yearly camp, the guys spent 5 days at Camp Bartlett, which is fully outfitted with a waterfront, boats, trails, a big lodge, and a staff prepared to help with merit badges. The same year, the young woman spent 3 days at Cinnamon Creek. As the name indicated, we had a creek. Also, we had a few harried moms, designated fire pits, an old rusty bathroom with a couple of showers, and I think we even had a couple of picnic tables. Of course, you know, these are programs of the church, and some wards and some bishops are changing. But to a young woman who as yet didn't have any real testimony of Christ, this inequality was very frustrating. I saw guys getting to do all the things I wanted, while I was told that my gender dictated I was suited more for indoor activities. More serious to me than the unfair programs, which I think can be changed, given enough pressure from women members, is the inequality rooted deeply in church culture and assumptions about church doctrine. For example, one Sunday when I was about 15, my bishop came in to give us the semi-annual chastity lesson. I was used to the nauseating idea that it's somehow my responsibility to keep a young man from sinning, but this time he had something new. He explained that God created sex only to keep a man tied to his family. Without sex, there is no reason that any man would voluntarily spend his life with a woman. Now,
there's one woman,
right? Yeah, one woman. Now, I know this isn't church doctrine, but it's very troubling to me that it's accepted for a man to think this, and even more troubling that the young woman would sit there going, "Yeah, yeah, that's really good." Two very dangerous practices of the church caught me here. One is identifying church culture with church doctrine, and the other is teaching that the church is an all-or-nothing thing. Look at my position. I was a bright 16-year-old frustrated with the inane activities ascribed to young women of my age by the church in the predominantly Mormon area. While this seems to be a culture issue, since other wards in other states are run quite differently, I was under the impression that these things were doctrinally mandated. I also saw obvious discrepancies between what my leaders told me and the innate realities of life. I had homosexual friends that treated everybody with respect, were very moral people. I had agnostic friends that treated people better than my Mormon friends. But I had been told all of my life that either the church was all true or none of it was true. So in my 16-year-old superiority, I decided to choose the latter and said that once I graduated from high school, I'd never set foot inside a Mormon church again. I wanted to be able to think, and the Mormons I knew tried to take that away from me. However, as seems to be the case with many young liberal Mormons, financial constraints narrowed my college options to BYU. I remained angry with the church, but my reasons became more than merely cultural. The problem is that my frustrations remained internalized. Besides my roommate and two friends, I could talk to no one. The atmosphere at BYU isn't generally conducive to free discussion. Criticizing leaders and doctrine is seen as apostasy. Then my second year at BYU, I met some Sunstoners. I won't bore you with the details of intellectual liberation, but now I meet with a group every Sunday night that discusses religion and philosophy, and we can ask questions, real questions. It was so incredible to find freedom of thought within the church. I've discovered that Mormonism does not have to be narrowly defined. As I look back in my teenage years, I realize that many of my problems came from not feeling comfortable voicing my opinions. Part of that was me and my insecurity, and part of it was that nobody wanted to listen to me. What I didn't realize until later is that not very many people are interested in real ideas of any kind, let alone ideas that challenge their assumptions about life. Perhaps I sound arrogant. That is not my intent. I only mean to convey the idea that people went out to deliberately suppress me. I just felt that no one was interested in my ideas, probably because few people are interested in ideas. Although discovering people who were willing to think and address difficult issues was wonderful, it didn't take away my fundamental questions. Since high school, I've become more able to distinguish between church culture and doctrine, but the discrimination against women I find there is even more troubling. What I value most is freedom, the freedom to think, to speak, and to exercise my God-given agency. Inseparably connected with this idea of freedom is the idea of equality. That is, in order for me to have freedom, I must be on an equal plane with the men. For this reason, the church's emphasis on eternal gender roles is very troubling to me. My freshman year, one of my friends did a survey for her women's studies class, and one of the questions was, "What do you think about the role of women in the church?" As she was filling out the survey, she paused at this question and said ironically, "I'm concerned that the church thinks there is a role for women." In the book Woman, written by a group of general authorities and published in 1979, I found some difficult information. In a chapter on women in the priesthood, I read the following: "The husband loves his wife as an extension of himself." The chapter also quoted an earlier general authority who said, "I say unto you, sisters, seek to have confidence in your husbands. Believe they are capable of leading you. When you seek instruction, believe them capable of giving it to you. Be faithful, humble, obedient to them. Their feelings should not be concentrated in you, but your feelings should be in them." It is one thing to argue against unfair programs and overzealous bishops. It is quite another to take on general authorities and establish doctrine. So far, I have mentioned only the problems with the church. Finding a forum for free discussion allowed me to see the beauty that remains through all the problems. I love the gospel. I need unconditional love. To me, the exciting things about the gospel and our scriptures are the stories that we learn. What little child does not wish to be Captain Moroni and stand up for the cause of liberty? What child does not covet the promise the Lord made to Nephi? In the Book of Mormon, we read, "If God had commanded me to do all things, I could do them. If he should command me that I should say unto this water, be thou earth, it should be earth, and if I should say it, it would be done." Our church teaches that we can have this power. We can be a part of this continual struggle. I feel a connection with the prophets. I too would have this spiritual peace. The problem is that the church tries to take this connection away from me. I can feel the blessings of the priesthood only through a worthy man. My spiritual power will come only through raising righteous children. Why must my contribution to the battle between good and evil be through another person? There are few women with whom I can connect in the scriptures, and my leaders tell me I can never have the power of the men. Where then is my connection with the gospel? I have struggled with relatives telling me that my duty is to have children as soon as I'm married rather than finishing college. My plans for graduate school are seen as ridiculous, a degree in physics considered vanity. I'm told to be obedient to my husband, to my leaders, to the priesthood. My autonomy and independence are taken away. I'm required to hide my brain instead of using it. I am not a second-class citizen and do not wish to be treated as one. Other women may have found the church much more conducive to independence. I, of course, can speak only for myself and my observations. This is my struggle. My dad is a bishop, and at the beginning of this year, he said that of the 27 young women, 19 were not attending meetings. I've noticed similar trends in other wards, and Linda gave the statistics that I found to back up this information. The church is losing its women. I think that for younger women, the church could easily change a lot of the inactivity. Teenagers often come to church if they think it's cool, or if their friends do, or if they do fun things. Few are thoroughly interested in doctrine. If the church creates a fun-filled, accepting environment, people will come. Make activities and camps equal. Instead of having the vaguely embarrassing personal progress, initiate a program that's equivalent to the Eagle Scout. Programs can change. Again, using my homeward as an example, the attendance rate is now such that only 4 young women aren't attending church. The stake has a dynamic young women's president who insists on equality. This year, the young women go to Camp Bartlett, exactly the same camp the young men attend. It is possible. The church also needs to tolerate and encourage diverse points of view. Last November, I participated on a panel on the future of Mormon feminism at the Mormon Women's Forum Counterpoint Conference. I was talking in the physics lab one day with a friend of mine, and he said, frankly, we don't need your kind here. My kind? What's my kind? As long as women are made to feel inferior for even considering ideas other than conservative doctrine, they will leave. Unfortunately, the other issues of equality for women are not so easily addressed, and in the interest of time and safety, I won't address them. How much time do I have? Okay. With all these problems that I've mentioned, why do I stay? At first, when I wrote this, wanting to end on a positive note, I said, I think the church can change. I think the church will change. About some things, this is true. Unequal programs can and will change given time and active leaders. But I don't think that the members of the church want very much to change. As I mentioned earlier, relatively few people are interested in real ideas. It's just easier for someone to tell you what to do. With the structure of the church the way it is, who will challenge these ideas except the relatively few who are interested in them? I am looking for truth. I am seeking for truth. I have not yet found it, but here, within the church, I have found people who care about ideas and about truth, if it exists. The Christ story appeals to me in a very fundamental way, but I do not know it is truth. Constantly searching without any sort of anchor is tiring, and so I choose the church as my anchor. I was born into this church. It is a good church, and it is possible to find a connection with the spiritual community. Maybe the ideas in the church are truer than others. Maybe they aren't. Maybe no ideas are truer than any other ideas. But in the meantime, I need to find peace. I love the Christ story and the real idea of unconditional love. Of course, all these things are available outside of the Mormon church, but as I said, I was born into this church. I have a common heritage with millions of people around the world, and it strengthens me. Perhaps I am too much of an idealist. Others have suffered for an inclusive perception of Mormonism. In a sense, I've been lucky. I've slowly awakened to the problems in the church without having any life-shattering experiences. There are no cases of spiritual, sexual, or physical abuse in my background. Although I felt stifled by my family, I believe it was unintentional. They loved me and encouraged me in many ways. I'm not yet bitter towards the church. The problems still exist and aren't going away. But I'll stay. I'll stay because I don't know what else to do. I'll stay because I have a deep hunger for spiritual creativity, unconditional love, and intellectual stimulation. I'll stay because I haven't found anything else that will give me this. Thank you.
We are doing this in order. I'm glad Ray went first because she, in many ways, reminds me of myself. I'm sure she reminds my mother of me. When Linda asked me to speak on the panel, she told me the topic and then asked me to discuss where I was today vis-a-vis the church and how I got there from where I was 10 years ago or so. Basically, she repeated the same story that she told you about my insistence that the church was never going to kick me out. But for me to understand myself where I am today, I really have to go back a lot further, somewhere between 15 and 20 years ago. I grew up in a church that in many ways was vitally different from the church that I encounter now or used to encounter on Sundays here in Utah. In other ways, and this may be the topic of another paper altogether, both of those churches remain fundamentally similar. I think, in fact, that Ray has done an interesting and very good explication of how the church is, the ways that I would argue that it's similar have to do with inequalities of women and men. But many of my early memories involve the church in one way or another. I can't remember how old I was, 6 or 7, when my mother signed my sister and I up to sing with a special youth group in sacrament meeting. She said later that Debbie and I were the youngest in the group by far, and that no one had told her this was a group of teenagers, not children. But I learned all of the words of all of the words to all three verses of I'm a Child of God from that experience. As a first grader in Seattle, I had a school classmate who I would occasionally visit after school, even though she lived quite far away from our neighborhood, because she was also Mormon. We moved the next year, and I spent the 4 years from age 7 to 11 in Kansas City, Missouri. In my memories, those 4 years are jammed-packed with activities of one kind or another, from extra practices for ward primary programs to ward dinners and bazaars of all kinds to the state play production that involved both of my parents and, as I recall, all 7 of us children. I still find an incident from the summer of my 11th year incredibly telling. We spent that summer traveling around the western United States, visiting different places where my parents were considering relocating after my father had finished his medical internship the following year. During one of our stops on the road for picnic lunch, I started talking to a couple of kids from another family who were also stopped at that rest stop. We talked about where they were coming from, what their family was like, and then I asked, "Well, what ward do you belong to?" It turned out they belonged to a ward somewhere in whatever city they were from, although their father didn't like them going to church very often, so they didn't. It didn't occur to me until we were back on the road how presumptuous the question had been. After all, they might have been Jewish or Presbyterian. This foundation of church involvement to the ideological, although not actual exclusion of everything else, is, I believe, the beginning point for where I am today. But there were other social and psychological influences as well. Colleen McDaniels, in her work on homeschooling and how it changes the religious life of fundamentalist families in the South, argues that homeschooling embeds the fundamental religious beliefs of the family, usually of the mother, much more strongly than normal schooling. At the same time, she argues the belief structure of the family is never quite the same as the Orthodox religion. Thus, the homeschoolers become different from the rest of the congregation. I know what she means. As I have commented to a number of friends and on the internet, I didn't really grow up in the Mormon church. I grew up in my mother's version of the Mormon church. As I remember it, that version was always striving harder for perfection and had higher standards of behavior and performance and was more strongly idealistic than the actual church. But, to my mother's credit, that's how I remember it. That doesn't mean that's how it was. It is It is hard in retrospect to extricate the influences of the quote-unquote real church from the influences of my mother's vision of the church. I believe it is true, as I have discovered in discussions with friends much more recently, that the real church served me as something of an escape from family, particularly during those periods of time that I was in homeschool. But in looking back, I still cannot separate the two well enough to determine where or when I developed my model of the good Mormon woman. In the same way that being Mormon was embedded in my being, so was the knowledge that I would someday marry and raise a family of wonderful, idealistically perfect children. And while I didn't expect perfection at a practical level, I was never a perfectionist cook or housekeeper, for example, that didn't matter because perfection wasn't doing. It was being. And being, of course, requires understanding what it means to be, which project involved many of my undergraduate years at BYU in the honors program, various honors colloquium, and studying with a broad array of the top people in Mormon letters. None of that... So in summary, I spent my undergraduate years and later my graduate years at BYU learning how to be a better person so that I would later be able to teach my children the same principles. Along the way, I was told the statistics about women who had to make their own livings, and I always took seriously the need for college education and even a graduate level education because I knew it was important to have something to fall back on. But my fundamental expectations... and more problematically, I'm finding now, my sense of my own identity were still rooted in the role models I had internalized growing up with, wife and mother. And so, through 5 years of undergraduate studies, a mission, a year in Mexico with my family, a year in Southern California teaching, that was an appalling experience, and 2 years of law school, that still was my goal. It wasn't until my last year of law school that I became increasingly aware that I was going to have to grow up and pay off my law school loans by myself. It was at that point that Sundays started becoming depressing. I no longer fit. I was now a career woman. There was no place, at least in my view of the church or my understanding, what I had grown up with, for me. I didn't have an identity as a career woman that I could mix with involvement in the church. I had no few, if any, role models. I find it shocking looking back that even as an undergraduate in the English department, which tends to have at BYU, which tends to have a fairly high ratio of single women, or at least career women, that the people and the professors that I associated with were not the women. And it never, the contradictions in the role models between the men and the women never sunk in. Since I've had to grow up, sort of, and develop a career, involvement in the church has become increasingly problematic and frustrating. Nothing that the church has taught me has helped me or is relevant particularly to an identity that I have had to develop of my own as a career person that does not in a role that does not involve motherhood or being a wife. And I don't know at this point, and frankly, I'm not particularly inclined to find out how much of that is me and how much of that is the church. What I do know is that I spent 3 to 4 years on the road going gradually inactive. And during that period of time, Sundays became increasingly depressing. I was entirely without a church for 2 to 3 years, and for Christmas and Easter services started attending the Episcopal Church. And although I don't consider myself in any way Episcopalian as opposed to Mormon, I am attempting now to develop a concept of myself as a Christian with a Mormon background.
As Linda said, I joined the church when I was 15, and now I'm the mother of a 15-year-old. She's the fourth of my 9 children. After 3 achieving boys, she appeared, and she's had a hard time from the beginning. Hava, my daughter, is everything that I never was. And I always feel haunted that I could inherently never give her what she needed. Surely I can never give her what she wants. She doesn't live at home with me now, and I don't even know if she goes to church or not. She hasn't lived at home for a couple of years. At 15, I first learned about the church through a friend. We were both, I say with a blush, cheerleaders. I I live with my friend's family for several months, escaping from my own family with an alcoholic father and a codependent mom. This family was a typical Latter-day Saint family, that is, if you live at home, you go to church. I attended everything, including early morning seminary. At 15, as shy as if I were walking around naked, the Mormon church seemed full of young people, bigger than life, confident, good-looking, braces and all. I had crooked teeth myself, but my mother would never get me braces. She said, "Look at Eleanor Roosevelt. She has crooked teeth. And look what she's done with her life." I remember sitting and gazing at the boys at the sacrament table with something close to worship. That first year, I loved being in the church. Everything was new. Everything was extraordinary, all in a language new to me, clean, gorgeous. I remember creating costumes for road shows and acting in them, and that memory still is charged with delight. For me, it was the young people's program was what the church intended, a feast of totally available, wholesome activities. Then that family moved to Albuquerque, and after a sodden experience with my stepfather, I moved to Albuquerque too. At 16 and 17, then allowed to date, then beginning to develop into who I really was, my experience of the church changed. The crooked teeth and the lack of Mormon vernacular, the shyness, well, just not being as pretty as the rest of them, certainly not as well dressed, suspiciously not as well healed, became painful for me. I went to all the activities with the popular kids, but it was clear that I was not one of them. I didn't even have a proper family, for heaven's sake. Starting university at the raw age of 17, just barely 17, I had a suitable arena to develop my own propensities for poetry and art, all of which put me quite out of the Mormon circle. The big charge of university life, modern dance, doing the literary magazine, all quite heady for a young 17, paled the youth conferences and mutual activities for me. As I remember it, it was like leading a double life. Same as now, we might say. My daughter's experience has been so totally unlike mine that I hardly think I'm addressing the same issues. She attended everything dutifully until she was about 12 and a half. Then she started running away, doing drugs, selling drugs, sleeping around, stealing, being in gangs, you name it, and it went on many times over. She identified the church with everything that she didn't want to do, and she wouldn't do any of it. Aside, the church had no resources for me. Their hands were thrown in the air as fast as mine were, and I tried lots of different things to help her. When in the early stages we tried to use the young women's program to lure her back by having the girls invite her to activities, she would say, "Those bitches hate me. I'm never going back there. If I ever see so-and-so, I'm going to kick her ass," etc. Hava, my daughter, is at the furthest end of the spectrum why Mutual doesn't answer the needs of many girls. Her life is so fast, so wild, so charged that Mutual is a foreign land. Interestingly enough, when she does get to sacrament meeting sometimes, she will experience the Spirit, and she will come a little closer to the family, perhaps to herself. But cute little decorations and girls' camp dramatizations of the iron rod and the tree of life, as she would say, yeah, right. Most Mormon girls have not spun so far away as Hava, but I bet we'd tremble a little bit if we knew what their lives are really like. I don't have statistics. I don't approach things in a very left-brain way, but my friends who work in Mutual say that a high percentage of the girls have a good deal of sexual experience. Many of them have tried alcohol, drugs. All of them have seen things in movies that most of us never knew about until we were married. Maybe we still don't know. The smooth, tanned, airbrushed, I've lost my place. Models that haunt their ideal dreams appall us, but those images drive those girls. And I think if you have girls, you know it. It drives the young girls. Lucky those cute Utah girls who, at least for a bright moment in their lives, can create a look like that. My boys, and I have many more boys, I have 6 boys and 3 girls. My boys have had a different experience in Mutual. The rough and manly exchanges in Scouts, which was mostly Mutual for them, give them a lot of fun. They don't take it too seriously. Although, there are lots of plenty of good campouts to go on. They do take the priesthood very seriously, although the Scouts and the priesthood are often mysteriously interwoven in some war doings. But my boys have seemed to manage with it okay. Most of them, though, have quit Mutual well before they were 18 as they developed into their own interest in their own selves. But I think the girls do take it very seriously. Not so much the activities, but the identity created for them that they feel they must deal with. I always say, and now my friends yawn and put their hands over their mouth, that what's wrong with the church is what's wrong with the culture. We all, those who are angry often point to the church and nag, but I say what's wrong with the church is what's wrong with the culture. And how do you undo a life of enculturation? You're born. The practice of controlling others, subtly or otherwise, runs strong in the best of us. A friend of mine with nonconforming teenagers, both boys and girls, considers that letting the kids be who they are at home is far more powerful than the influence that the church might have in trying to make them conform. She pointed out that the parents' enculturation into being standard Mormons pressures the kids, the parents pressure the kids to be standard more powerfully than the church does. You know, you can't have your driver's license till you get your eagle, and so on. She also mentioned that her one particular daughter with Hava-like tendencies is stabilized at church, and she thanks her lucky stars that at least there's something that can help stabilize her amongst all the pressures. One of the things that I saw that worked in our stake and wards were survival-like trips with leaders who were willing to risk and be real. I have seen kids come back from those trips real, happy, peaceful, filled. But it doesn't last long because the culture is unrelenting. What would I do? Don't ask me. Faced with difficult problems like this, I'm for throwing the whole thing into the air, letting it fall and break, and seeing what survives, if anything survives. It doesn't bother my testimony of God or of the church. I'm just glad I don't have to wrestle the problem. I've never served in Mutual. However opposite and my daughter and myself might be, we are still both somehow struggling toward the genuine, and I'm really not sure at this point in my life how much of that we are finding in the church.
No, I just can't resist commenting on Ray's idea that there's no equivalent to the eagle in the church. What about that virgin on a chain thing? Okay, I am concerned about another thing, and you said, Ray, you said that your relatives pressure you, say you should have kids as soon as you're married rather than finishing college. Now, I managed to do both. My daughter Patty managed to do both. She didn't get her head on straight and really start in college till she had 3 kids, and she had twins during her clinical part of nursing.
Oh, I think you can. But it was explicitly stated that I should have kids instead of finishing college.
Well, we don't listen to that kind of advice, do we? Okay, I'm going to start and ask the three of you to respond briefly to a question that was sent in after our radio broadcast on Tuesday. It says, how do you deal with equality when it comes to young men receiving the priesthood? When a 12-year-old boy becomes a deacon, when he's told that he now has the power of God and the keys to command angels, that's an incredible boost to his self-esteem. The youth is given responsibilities and duties. He performs important tasks in front of the entire ward. He's groomed for leadership. I question that. Being taught all kinds of leadership skills. I think the girls get more of that, but this is his question. What does the young woman get? And he says, assuming women won't be receiving the administrative priesthood in the Mormon church very soon, how do you compensate the young women? How would you make what would you do to make them feel as important as the deacons and other priesthood holders feel? Who wants to start?
I will.
Okay.
I don't think you can. I don't know how to do it. Maybe I'm still too bitter, but I see no way to solve that problem without the obvious answer.
Okay. Short, not very sweet. Okay.
Myself, my daughters ask me that question, and I say, I
don't know. I don't understand. I can't say.
Okay, let's see. Go ahead. Can we move this? I guess we can.
My answer was, I don't know. My daughter's asked me that question. It's painful. It goes right to my heart. I don't know. You want to say your answer again?
That's what they all said.
And I said, ditto, I don't think you can, period. Organizationally, it's impossible. You set up a structure of inequality.
That's because there is no end.
There is.
I agree. I don't think there's any answer except what one of you said the obvious answer was, which is that, that the young women need to be given the priesthood at the same time. And it's not answered by having young women pass out programs in church.
The microphone,
this should be familiar. It will not stretch to the back.
I'm a frustrated Sunday school president in our ward. You talked about young women, but you didn't talk about the Sunday school. And probably nobody talks about the Sunday school. Nobody comes either. I used to teach the 12-year-olds before they could get a teacher for the class. And this year their curriculum is the presidents of the church. When you were talking, it just occurred to me that not too many of the presidents are women, and so that might be a good role model for the men, but not for the women. And in the older classes, they have the same curriculum exactly as the adults, which I find terribly boring when I visit the adult class. And do you have any advice for me, what to say something about Sunday school?
My experience in Sunday school was nobody ever came except the one time when our teacher was the janitor at the high school, who was also very involved in the theater program. All the kids loved him. We'd come in and he'd say, okay, the lesson today is about when the pigs ran into the sea with Christ. Don't, you know, it's a nice story. The moral is be good. And then we talked the rest of the hour. And then everybody came. Everybody loved it. I don't know how you mix things. I don't know.
My kids and I were talking about this subject, about Sunday school, and I only have another question to answer the question, which is, when I'm a substituting, I don't teach Sunday school anymore, the lesson is listened to with kindness and respect because we love each other. And then we talk about the real things. And I find that most of what the children and young people are interested in is not coherent with what the lesson has to do with. And for me, the best thing that worked in Sunday school for young people was to take the scriptures and read them and say, what does that mean? And they would say, I don't know. And I say, well, you have to know. Tell me. And that was our best approach, but not every young person likes that.
Any more questions? Oh, you're just waving it. Do we have any more questions? Okay. We had another one that was submitted earlier after the radio broadcast. It says, there seems to be an artificiality about much of the young women's program. Contrivances to produce good behavior, spirituality, etc., gimmicks maybe. What kind of approach do you feel could avoid that and create genuine spiritual and personal growth?
I hate to preface everything by saying I know this isn't going to happen, but why don't we go ahead and get the Girl Scouts in the church? I know that they've given various reasons why not to, but let's have the Girl Scouts. My daughter's a Girl Scout, and it's good.
Hey, I was a Brownie leader the same year I was mutual president.
I called the Girl Scouts and asked, and they don't want to be in the church.
I got it.
That's just in Utah. It's hard to believe that the whole organization wouldn't like the funding we fund into the Boy Scouts. In Utah, however, in some wards, women are asked. I know of three different wards, three different occasions this happened. I don't know how much broader it is, where women were asked to resign from being Girl Scout leaders because that was not what the church wanted them to do. Okay. Helen, were you telling me time? Okay.
Hi. I was the neighborhood Girl Scout chairman. My girls were Girl Scouts.
One of them loved it, one of them hated it. They had the same kind of personal feelings as they did toward young women. My son said, I won't be an Eagle Scout. I hate those guys. Don't make me go on any more Scout trips. I'd rather not drive than get my Eagle Scout. I said, well, learn all the skills then. That's what it's all about. For my children, and one of my daughters is no longer active in the church. One daughter is. My son thought he wouldn't be, but now he's decided he will be. But it's not been a problem of inequality between the men's program and the women's program, per se, as my daughters haven't wanted the priesthood. My 12-year-old daughter would never want to get up and pass the sacrament. She would never want to stay after and put up the chairs. She would never want to go to those extra meetings. But they have wanted the equal activities. My daughter said, how come they get to go water skiing and we have to stay home and make strawberry jam and make pies? That's no fun. You know, that it's the money thing. It's the budget thing. And my experience has been that there is, according to discretion of leaders, there is some giving of, oh, well, the young women want to do that kind of thing. But my children have really struggled with this. But it has been across the board. My young men and my young women, and it has depended more on the social group than anything else, whether they are accepted by the social group or not.
My law training and the combined with the organizational behavior training lead me to one inexorable conclusion. Separate but equal never works.
Yeah, Brown versus Board of Education, read it.
Do you see the problems and potential solutions as institutional or individual? Because it seems to be the case that some words do badly and some do well, some leaders do badly and some do well.
Individual, I see that there is a lot of space for making choices. And I've heard of women and young women who press for something that they want and get it. But again, it comes back to my big thing of enculturation. Most of us don't even think of it. Don't even think of it to begin to ask for it.
I think it's both organizational and individual. There are some things, of course, I think the way the structures of the church now, you're supposed to have equal programs for men and women. It's just the culture that's not that way. If you can get individual leaders that will make the effort to change, then it will change. And then it's organizational in the sense of things we've already talked about, that who knows if the church will ever change on those issues. And I thought it was interesting when we were last night listening to the session that conservative churches do best. Maybe we're just the minority. Maybe things will always be this way because that doesn't seem like people really want to change.
I think my answer would be that the problems are more institutional than individual, and that the successes come because of the recognition of individuals or the strivings of individuals to, in some cases, become more Christ-like, which in itself has its roots in some institutional training, I suppose, that the successes come from those I don't want to say aberrations. yes, exceptions is a better word. Thank you.
I think that what Marty has said, leads on the point that we heard in conference 4 years ago, and I can't remember who was speaking, but it was prefaced with a reference to Volume 4 in the Church History, where they said that the church and the leaders can and needed the women. And we've heard this all the time, but specifically pointed out that because the women in the New Relief Society were able to act on the sympathies that God has placed in their bosom, other people see them and come to the church. And whoever was talking 4 years ago after pointing out every priesthood blessing and ordinance is available to the women, referred to Matthew 4, where Christ was unable to accomplish what he wanted to accomplish because of unbelief. They said that the priesthood cannot go forward if the way is not prepared. And goes on to, who did Christ first meet after the resurrection? Who did he first teach? It was the women's, because their hearts were prepared and the men's were not. And coming down to issues like the priesthood and the blacks that most of us thought we would never see. But when the hearts are there, those things change. And it seems to me that the church is on a balance between the church as a whole, and we all know of stories of this, stories of events of scapegoating. John D. Lee was offered up because the church needed statehood. Apostle Taylor was excommunicated. No, I guess it was Apostle Taylor that was excommunicated over the polygamy issue because the church needed acceptance. There are issues like this. In those particular cases, the men accepted that role. Nowadays, many people are being scapegoated without their willing, in some cases, participation. But if the church, if, you know, if the leaders are balancing and we believe that they have God's, Christ's direction in this balancing, then, as they pointed out in the November 79 Anson, women are the major growth in the church, and their righteousness and articulateness then prepares the hearts of others to accept. And nothing is more important than preparing the hearts of the families and the children. And as a man just told me this morning, he says, hey, it's easy to go out and work and leave it at the end of the day. You guys have the hard part. But if this is the role, to prepare the hearts, not to compete with men, it's certainly something that men can't do. And if it's a balance between what the church needs, then perhaps we have to look and see what we as women need to learn out of this, not what the men need to put on us because of this, just for those men of you here. But the older I get, the more strongly I believe that all bad things, all unfair things, all unequal things can be turned to our advantage. And let's face it, if it was reversed, if there has to be, socially, from way back when, if we look at the evolution, there was a really bad situation. Then we had the Jewish Old Testament, and that brought us a little bit higher standard. Then we have Christ in the New Testament that brought us a little bit further. And then we had Joseph Smith in the church. Each of those is predicated on the state we were in before. And so I guess we have to get through this state, and enough people have to want it to accept. Elder, who's that guy? Dunn seemed to get away from his keepers a few weeks ago, and he gave a most delightful talk. But one of the things he talked about was being under either three or four. He was an apostle under three or four church presidents. Before the blacks received the priesthood. He said every one of those, he went and said, now wait, why, you know, this is not doctrinal. Why do we continue with this policy? And each one of them said, the church is not ready. When Christ wants it to happen, it will happen. And he sounded like he was just a little bit smug when it finally happened, and he got to go to the apostle that was sitting next to him, whose name shall remain unmentioned. But I think that if for the church to survive at this point, even on the level that it's on, it has to continue because we are not ready for women to have the priesthood, because if the women had the administrative priesthood right now, I don't think we'd have very many men at church, frankly. They need their titles. Now, hopefully we're going to grow to that point. Okay, you can. Okay, go ahead. Oh, no, we never wait until everybody's happy. We never wait until everybody.
The majority of people, or even a large group of people, for them to want the women to have, never going to have. Leaders of the church don't want it to happen because power issue has to do with the balance. It's a power issue. They don't want women to have the priests. They don't want their power usurped.
Okay, and this may be entirely correct, but if we have a testimony that Christ is at the head of the church, rather than we're just merely running a social organization here, then we have to defer. And we have to continue to agitate and question and make it more of an issue and make it more acceptable. Just like they did with...
Well, you just introduced a different question that sort of took all the air out of my balloon, because that's not where I'm coming from. But what I'm going to do right now is just start taking my daughters to a church where women are pastors and solve it that way.
Okay.
I have a couple of problems with some of the things that you said. Maybe I wasn't listening.
Somebody has a problem with something I said.
Well, I have a problem with most things. I'm 48 and single, and I've never been married, never born children. Consequently, I have no value. But the one thing that...
Did you say value or values?
I said, well, either. You ask the people in my ward, and they'd say neither. But the main thing that I wanted to say about what you just got finished saying is, when we say that women have to do this spiritual thing, you already give the men a reason not to have to rise to their potential as far as being nice and kind and spiritual to other people. And I think that's the problem. If there's not enough that they run the things and organize and get the chairs set up, and then we have to come and bring the spirit, that gives them a whole lot of out, you know, and I don't like that, for one thing. But the other thing is you think you have problems when you're younger, when you're 48 and single in the church. I am very pitied. And granted, there are things I should be pitied for, but it's not for my marital state. That's not the thing I should be pitied for, because I'm not supposed to be able to be happy, and I've been told that from a million people in the church, because I don't have children, I don't have a husband, for which I feel grateful, thank you very much. And at the same time, you know, I'm not a homosexual either, and so those are my two choices. I either had to be unhappy or a homosexual. And absolutely. But you can't be a heterosexual unhappy if you're in the church and not married. But it is institutional what they do, because they never teach us how to be people. They teach me how to be a wife, a mother, a teacher, a seminary teacher, a missionary, but they never teach me how to be Carolyn Dalton and have that be applauded.
Well, as 54, and my husband bailed on me last year, there's plenty of women in my ward that have individually and quietly said, gee, you're so much happier now that you're divorced. I said, it's a lot easier. I can't be happy, though, because to one group of people, I committed heresy when I went and got a couple of graduate degrees. To the other group of people, the ones with mostly with the degrees, I committed heresy when I had 14 children. So, see, I can't be happy on any grounds.
And that's exactly why men having the priesthood and women not having it isn't the biggest issue. It's looking at people as individuals, not as colonies in the church.
Okay, I think that is crucial, and we will end on that note.